It's my utmost pleasure to welcome you to the last lecture of the Machine Learning for the Greenhorns course. Given that it's the last lecture, there will be several organization points that I will start with before I will let you to ask the questions, which usually you can at the beginning. So first, the course is now ending. Generally, this is the second repetition of the course. So this is the second year where the course is taught. It's still visible on the course, meaning that the slides are still being improved and the tasks are being edited and errors are present in the slides and so on and so on. So I would be extremely interested in some feedback in this area. If you have some idea what could be done to make the course easier, more understandable, better, more funny, more enjoyable, whatever your ideas would be, then I would be grateful for letting me know. Feel free to, I don't know, write to Piazza, write me an email or talk to me. Either even here or on the practicals, like any channel, or fill the official I actually don't know how it's called in the student information system. You can like fill in the like students' opinions about the lectures. It has probably some different name, but I actually don't know how it's called in English. And there you can also have some general text comments regarding the course. So all of these channels are available to you, and please don't hesitate to tell me, because it's like, as you know, like more heads know more stuff. When I mentioned this like student poll, or maybe it's poll, about the courses, then if you like the course, then please fill this student poll, because the filled poll makes it easier. Like it gives some signal that the course is actually working and it's still the second one. So if then we want the points to be so, like, if people like the course, it makes the better position for the lecturer to, I don't know, set the course more advanced and more in advance to set the term and so on and so on. So also, if you didn't like it, then also fill the student poll, because I would be like, I would like to know what you didn't like, so that it can be actually improved on. So that's one thing. The other thing are the chocolates. I promised the chocolate to everybody, anybody who like finished at most third in every competition, and then at some point I stopped giving those. The reason for that was that the chosen shop wasn't really delivering in a reasonable way, and they kind of stopped communicating. So I like stopped doing it, but it doesn't mean you will not get the chocolate. So generally, the chocolates will be available. They will be available in the Czech Republic. So if you are abroad, then unfortunately, you will have to come come here to collect your rewards. But they will be available somewhere in Prague, I assume. So once you will be able to go to school, you'll be able to pick it up. Don't worry, stay tuned. There will be more announcements on this on the Wednesday's practicals. The most, I would say, interesting thing from your point, or the most pressing, are of course the exams. Given the pandemic situation, which is not getting better after the Christmas, definitely, it's kind of tricky to actually organize the exams. So anyway, the university extended the examination period by two weeks. So the examination period will take 8 weeks from the next week until the end of February. And there definitely will be exams which will be in person, and there will be exams which will be just online. The university or the faculty, like wants the students to take the person or in-person exam unless there are some reasonable reasons which would prevent in doing so. So usually the reasons preventing coming to a personal exam is that either you are abroad or you live like too far from Prague to just come to the exam and then go home. And given that there is no school accommodation running, then if you live like 200 kilometers away, then that is definitely a valid reason for not coming to the personal exam. So there will be both of these possibilities. There will be term dates for both of these types of exams in the student information system, but you'll be able to apply or to enqueue into the prison exams. And if you want to take part in the online examination, then you'll have to write me, tell why you cannot go to Prague, and then you will be able to take the online exam. It's a bit more complicated if you want to take the online exam, meaning you have to write, but that's there because I like to check that everybody who wants to do that actually have a reasonable reason for doing so. The form of the online exam is still not obvious. It's a fact that it is not as good or equal to the in-person exam. And people are still like trying to find a reasonable way so that the examination is like reasonably fair, but also not too technically demanding or not like not requiring you to have like a lot of cameras pointing at you and so on and so on. So there will be some news regarding this on Wednesday, and at that point I will commit to some version. But the two considered options are either that you will write the answers somehow, or that the online exam would be just an oral one. I still don't know, but anyway, there will be the same set of questions for both the in-person exam and the online exam. And the questions are unfortunately still not available. They should be available at the end of the week or at the beginning of the next week, this also means that there will be nearly no exams in the next week, in the first week of the examination period, given that you don't have the questions any right now. There were some exceptions which wrote to me, so all the confirmed exceptions, of course, will hold, but the official exams will start in this course will start at the second in the second week of the examination period. So that's the examination part. Yep. So I think that's nearly everything. One last thing, like the semester is ending, but it also means the new semester will start. And so what you can do if you like, find out that you like machine learning, I hope everybody has found out, but if you would like to learn something more, then there are some other machine learning courses which I give. In the summer semester, there is the so-called deep learning course. In the deep learning course, that's actually the first one which I did, and that concentrates only on one small area of machine learning, and that's supervised machine learning using neural networks, right? Or maybe even unsupervised, but not reinforcement learning. But the important thing are the deep neural networks. Like, so we talked about MLPs, but there are ways how you can actually train models which are substantially better than the MLPs which we talked about, and this is all done on Discord. So that's something you can do in the winter semester if you want to. Note that while the Greenhorns course is, how do you say it? For the Greenhorns course, you get obligatory voluntary, I don't know how it's called, like you get some credits which are not just like any credits, but you can use them. I'm really bad at this. If you know how it is called, then don't hesitate to tell me. But in your plans, sometimes if you choose among some of the courses to get enough of these, I don't know, obligatory voluntary credits or obligatory choosable credits, I don't know. So that's what you can get in bachelor for the Greenhorns course. For the deep learning course, you can get these credits, but in your master studies, right? So I am not sure how you can transfer, how well you can transfer these across the bachelor master studies, but formally the deep learning course is for master students, but it's definitely possible to go there in your third bachelor year or something. There are also other courses which I give, especially a course in reinforcement learning, but that one actually requires you to be able to work with deep learning already, so I won't talk too much about it. Instead, I will give a commercial about it on the deep learning course. The reinforcement, I think, is in the winter semester anyway. So this was just a small commercial. And now, do you have any questions? So if there are no questions, then let's get to the topic of our today's lecture. Today's lecture is much more statistical than the other ones. We will actually perform no machine learning during the lecture. But the goal of the lecture is to talk about like model comparison. If you get several models, then ideally we would like to be able to say that this model A is better than a model B. And until now, we already did this kind of a task in the competition evaluation, right? It was, oh, okay, this is the best one, this is the second best, and so on. And what we did is we just looked at the performance on the test set and then just ordered the models according to their performance. However, this might not be really a fair thing. It might happen that for one specific model, the examples which were present in the test set were specifically good for this model. But if we have chosen different examples, then some other models might be better. So this variance or variability in the possible test data should be probably also included in a fair model comparison. But doing that somehow soundly is much more complicated than it looks. So that's the goal of the today's lecture, to speak about how we can generate confidence intervals or standard deviations of the results, and how we can test whether model A is actually better than the model B, ideally on any possible test set. For that, we will need to talk about statistical hypothesis testing. So at the beginning, there is a huge warning, and this warning can be expressed by this variation of the famous saying, which states that there are various kinds of truth, like there is a truth, half-truth, lie, then there is a disgusting lie, and finally there is statistics. And I will try to show you that it is and is not the case at the same time. So statistical testing. In statistical testing, we assume that we have some hypothesis, which is testable when using some observed data. So let's say that we have some experiment, the experiment gives us some result, which are like observations of random variables. And assume that we have some hypothesis which influence the results. So they are kind of testable. And that's what we would like to do. So we would like to, given some observations, decide whether some hypothesis is true or not. There are two different views how we can look at it. The first one is the one proposed by the original author or the original father of the statistical hypothesis testing. And in that one, we assume that we have a hypothesis. It's usually called a null hypothesis. And we are interested in knowing whether we can reject it using the observed data. So we are not going to prove that it's true. Instead, we will try to reject it if it is possible. The reason why we are rejecting instead of confirming the hypothesis is that it's actually much more simple to invalidate a statement. Like specifically, if we have a theorem which says, oh, for all numbers or for all elements or for all random samples, this holds, then if you want to disprove, it's fine just to find one instance, one example, which doesn't hold for the hypothesis. On the other hand, proving that it's correct means that you need to say that you need to prove that for all possible values, combinations, inputs, whatever, the theorem holds, which is usually much more complex. So that's the thing which we'll be doing here. If we observe some random variables which invalidate the hypothesis, then they will allow us to reject it. But if we saw a sample from the distribution from a result of the experiment which doesn't invalidate the hypothesis, we cannot say that it holds, right? Because there can be a lot of other examples where it would not hold. So this is the framework. And we say that the result is statistically significant if it is extremely unlikely that the observed data have occurred given the null hypothesis, right? So what we will do is we will assume that the null hypothesis is true, and we will somehow evaluate the probability or the likelihood of the observed data. And if it will be extremely low, then we will say that the result is statistically significant. So we can reject the hypothesis without causing a lot of problems. Of course, just saying extremely or very unlikely, it's like hand waving. So we will need some threshold of this likelihood, right? Like what it is extremely unlikely. And this level will be the significance level. It will be called the significance level of the test. So this is one way, looking at it, that we have the hypothesis which we want to reject. Alternatively, we can look at it that we have two hypotheses. One is the null hypothesis, and then there is the alternate hypothesis, and we want to distinguish among them. This is usually when you have a hypothesis, it's like some hypothesis which you think holds. Right. Usually it's more interesting to prove that something is true. This first interpretation doesn't really allow us to do that. So now let's consider two hypotheses. Unfortunately, we will still be able to get only very similar outcomes. The first outcome is that we can reject the null hypothesis if the data is, again, very unlikely to occur given the null hypothesis. Or if it's not true, we will not reject the null hypothesis. But in neither of these cases, we can actually prove the alternate hypothesis. So we kind of think that it's, we kind of want to prove or want to convince others that it holds, but we will not be able to do it directly. Instead, we will be only rejecting the null hypothesis. What we can do is we can look at it as the following analogy. Like, we have a theory and you want to show that it holds. So what you do is you devise an opponent. You come up with an opponent for the theory and let them like wrestle. Like, every theory will be shouting the argument, and they will be hitting their weak spots with various data and so on and so on. And some of them will win, right? And if your theory wins a lot, then that may be an indication that it is actually true. Right, I'm not saying it's a proof, but if you disprove a lot of alternative theories, then the chance that your original theory is true probably increases. However, you must choose some appropriate opponent, right? If the null hypothesis is going to be just a weak opponent, then well, rejecting it will probably not make the position of your alternate hypothesis much better. But if instead you choose really good and strong null hypothesis, then rejecting it improves like the chances of your hypothesis. And the most extreme case is when the null hypothesis is the negation of the alternative hypothesis, right? If this alternate hypothesis is really just the negation of that, then by rejecting the null hypothesis, you kind of like put forward the alternate hypothesis, because there are no other possibilities if they are really just the opposites of each other. So we talked about the significance level. So now when we have two hypotheses, let's talk about what the significance level can be interpreted as. To that regard, we will talk about the type 1 and type 2 errors. We have already actually seen them, but we didn't call them type 1 and type 2 errors. Let's consider this frequently used courtroom trial example, which is used a lot to explain these significance levels. So let's say that we have a criminal trial. There is a defendant, and as in the usual court systems, it's considered not guilty until their guilt is actually proven, right? So what we will have the null hypothesis not guilty. And what we can do, we can either reject it. So if we have seen observations which indicate that the defendant is guilty, then we will reject the null hypothesis, and this will prove that it is actually guilty, right? So what we will do is we will accept this alternative hypothesis, because there are negations of each other that it is guilty. So when we look at this confusion matrix, we have already actually seen that when we were talking about the F-score, right? We have already seen these true negatives and false negatives, false positives, and true positives. So in this context, first let's assume that the defendant is actually not guilty. Then if we didn't reject the null hypothesis, we made a correct decision, and this is like a true negative. We said, okay, we cannot disprove the null hypothesis, so not guilty, and that's a correct decision, right? Similarly, in the opposite case, where the defendant is actually guilty and we were able to disprove the null hypothesis, then we made a correct decision, and the result is true positive. So we accepted the alternative hypothesis, which was a good thing to do. And now we have two types of errors, the false positives and false negatives. The false positives are the people who are not guilty, but the null hypothesis was rejected for them. So they have been proven guilty. So we have seen some observations which led us to believe they actually are guilty. This is a false positive. So we said that they are guilty, but it was a bad decision. And it's called a type 1 error. And this is exactly the problem which we try to limit. Like here, we said that the result will be significant. If it's very unlikely that the observed data have occurred given the null hypothesis. So this is exactly this, right? We have the null hypothesis, we assume that it's true. And this is the error, like this is the observation which lead us to reject the null hypothesis. And we want to limit the error rate of this happening. So these are the so-called type 1 errors, and the significance level is exactly the error rate, like the frequency of these type 1 error occurring. There is also the second kind of error, which means that we should have rejected the null hypothesis, but we didn't do so, right? So it was possible to do it, but maybe we didn't look at the right evidence. We looked in some different area, or we just couldn't find it, something. And this is the kind of error which the test doesn't really considers, or not much. And that's because we really only try to be able to reject the hypothesis instead of being able to prove that it holds. So that's the significance level. Crucial part of the statistical test is the so-called test statistic. The test statistic is some kind of statistic which describes the observed data or summarizes the observed data. Usually it's just a single value. And this single value is useful, it can be used to actually distinguish between the null and the alternative hypothesis. There are a lot of test statistics, but the important thing is that if it is just a single value, what we want to be able to do is we need to be able to compute the distribution of the test statistic. So we want to be able to evaluate the probability of the some value to be observed. And if we are able to do it, if we know the distribution, or if we compute or at least estimate the distribution of the test statistic, then we can use it to compute the p-values. The p-value, that's the probability of observing results which are at least as extremes as the one which we actually observed. What does it mean? It means that, let's say that there is some null hypothesis, and now we see some data. And we want to somehow quantify that these data are extremely unlikely given the null hypothesis. So the p-value tells us for a given observation, if we have already seen some outcome, what is the probability over other possible trials, other possible samples, that the result will be as bad or even worse than whatever we have just seen. So let's look at some images. So let's say that we have some distribution of the test statistics, right? So let's say that we have some distribution, and we want to prove that the mean of the distribution is zero or not, right? So first, let's consider a null hypothesis that the mean of the distribution, now I have to do it correctly, less or equal to zero. So this is our null hypothesis, right? And what we do is we can sample the observations from this distribution. That will be our test. And the p-value for some value t gives us, in this case, the probability that the observed test statistics, so that the observed mean of the trials, is larger than a given threshold T. So this is the one-sided right tail test, right? So it means that if we have this distribution of the statistics, we compute the probability that the outcome is at least some threshold or even larger. Like if this probability is extremely unlikely, then we can reject, and it happens, then we can reject the null hypothesis, right? So let's say that we have this threshold, like this is zero, right? So if the p-value for zero is, I don't know, 10%, or let's say 1%, like let's say the p-value for the zero is 1%, then it means that there is just 1% chance of seeing zero or even larger value, assuming that the null hypothesis holds. So this p-value can be defined in various ways because of this, like at least S extreme, right? So if we want to prove that something is less or equal to some value, then what we care about is the situation where the outcome is actually larger, right? But it can also be the other way around. We might won't be interested in results which are extremely small, or it might be the case that we actually want the result to be around zero, and both extremely large or extremely small outcomes are bad, are wrong, are like disproving the null hypothesis. So usually we just say a p-value, and depending on the test statistics, we mean one of these three quantities, right? Either just one-sided error on an appropriate side, or a two-sided one. So that's a p-value, like the probability that the observed results are as bad as the ones which we saw, or even worse. So finally, what the overall testing procedure looks like. Well, I didn't write it explicitly, but we should start by formulating the null and the alternate hypothesis. And then we should do the experiment, the measurements, right? And using the results, we should compute the observed value of the test statistics. The test statistic, very frequently it is like a mean of the observation, but it can be anything, but it's usually not the full data. It's usually just this one quantity for which we'll be able to compute the distribution of the p-values. So after we've observed the value, we'll compute the p-value, so the probability that it happened accidentally under the null hypothesis. And then we will reject the null hypothesis if the p-value is less than the chosen significance level. So if the significance level is like the probability of the type 1 error is at most 0.5%, then if we have observed data which have probability 0.5% or even less when assuming the null hypothesis, then we will reject it. Otherwise, we will do nothing. Otherwise, we were not able to do the rejection. So this is the overall procedure. But the most interesting and crucial part is the test statistics. So there are many and many kinds of test statistics, but before we talk about some specific ones, let's talk about their categorization. Like when we consider the statistics, then usually we either have one distribution, like one experiment, which we one kind of experiment which we want to perform, or we have some more. So we can have like two. So either we can have one sample tests or two sample tests. In one sample tests, we sample value from one distribution, and then we want to usually check for either the mean of the distribution to be greater or less or equal to zero. So for example, I don't really have a good example for this. So instead, let's get to the second case, and maybe I'll come with a good example for the first one is for later. We can also check for a goodness of fit. Like let's say that we have got a die, and we would like to know whether it's a fair die. So let's say that it's like six-sided die, and we would like to know that, or we would like to verify that all the sides have an equal probability of being the result of a toss. When we want to perform such a test, then usually the null hypothesis is that it is actually a fair die, and we try to reject it given the observed data. The observed data are some number of tosses and their results. And so the one sample test, which would test the goodness of fit, would tell us what is the probability that the observed data comes from the some categorical distribution with given parameters, assuming that these data are actually sampled from this distribution, right? So the null hypothesis is that we are actually sampling from this specific distribution. So usually this can be like, I don't know, for the six-sided die, it would be just a uniform distribution over six values, right? Something like this. And now our observations will be like some number of ones, twos, threes, fours, fives, and six. And the p-values in this case would tell us what is the probability that we observe these results if we assume that the data actually comes from this distribution, so that the die is really fair. Yeah. So this is here we check like the full distribution. In the first case where we test the mean of the distribution, then what we can do, for example, we can consider like the difference between two models. So like we can consider the difference in performance, and we might be interesting whether this difference is on average greater than zero or smaller than zero. So this is one sample test. We only have one distribution, and in the two sample tests we have two distributions. That's more appropriate for our usage later, because we will usually have some number of models, and we will want to compare them and say, okay, either this distribution A or B is better, meaning that, for example, the mean of the distribution A is larger than the mean of the distribution B. And in these two sample tests, there are two ways how this can work. Either we sample independent samples from these two distributions. That means that, let's say that we want to prove that people whose given name starts on A are, I don't know, higher than people whose given name starts on B. So we've got two distributions, the heights of the A guys and the height of the B guys, and we sample some number of A guys, some number of B guys, then we get these two values. So maybe we get two means, right? One distribution of heights for the A guys and then for the B guys, and then we want to probably say that the A guys are higher than the B guys. So we will take the null hypothesis, which will be the negation, so that the B guys are actually higher than the A guys. And then we will compute the probability of observing the results, assuming that actually the B guys are larger. However, in many cases, we sample from distribution, but using some paired samples. That's what will happen in our model case. We have one piece of data, I don't know, the image which we want to classify in the MNIST dataset. And then we give the same data to the model A and to the model B. And then we get the results. So in this case, we have these paired outcomes. So we don't need to construct the full distribution of outcomes for A and B. Instead, we can consider the results on the individual paired samples. And we usually do so by computing the difference. Right, when we have some experiments performed on like the same individuals, same units, same elements, then we can consider the difference between the results and then perform this one sample test. So this one sample test, which checks for mean to be greater than zero, is actually what we will use, right? We will have some data, we will compute so we have some test sets. We will compute the outcomes on the test sets, and we will be interested in knowing whether the model A is better than the model B. So when we look at the differences on the test sets, we want to know whether the mean is actually larger than zero or less than zero. Yep. In courses like in statistics or probability, you will probably be dealing with statistical testing a lot. So maybe you have already heard everything which I just said. But I think it's a good thing to be really careful. But anyway, you will learn about a lot of commonly used test statistics. Usually these will assume some normality of the data which we work with, or they don't. There are really many of them. Actually, we will not use any of them in our model comparison application. Generally, it's difficult to say that the predictions of models have some specific distributions. It's even difficult to say that the data which we use in machine learning have some specific distribution. So these test statistics will not actually be much useful to us, but I still want to mention them anyway. On the slides, I only have the names. I will add some brief descriptions later. But the Z test is a test where the test statistics has a normal distribution. For example, if you sample from a normal distribution with a known variance, you really need to know it. And you would like to know whether the mean is larger than zero or not, then the distribution over the p-values is also normal distribution, right? You know that the normal distribution has a specific shape, but you don't know where it should be. Right, and what you see is you see some number of observations, and from these observations you can actually compute the probability of this data in the normal distribution, right? And that allows you to compute the distribution of the p-values, which is also a normal one. However, in most cases you actually don't know the variance. So the Z tests are not really used that much. However, this is improved by the student's T test. I assume that the T test is something which you already have heard about. And the T test tells you, allows you to test the mean value of a distribution which is normal, but you don't know what the variance of the distribution is. What you usually do is you estimate the variance from data, so you somehow compute the estimated variance and then use it as the parameter of this normal distribution. But it's just a sample. It's very probable that there is some kind of an error in the sample variance. It's probably not very large, but there is some, right? And because of this uncertainty, then this distribution of the p-values in this case is not completely normally distributed. It's quite similar, still quite bell-shaped, but the distribution has slightly heavier tails because there is also always the chance that the variance which you use is erroneous. So you need to consider also this larger or smaller variances, which changes the distribution a bit. So this and using this the statistic means like performing a t-test. It can be used in many cases when you have data which are normally distributed. And given the central limit theorem, the means of identical independent identically distributed samples converges to the normal distribution. So this is a test which is used a lot in many situations. It's based on the T distribution. It's called the student T distribution. That's really a different, a weird name. So this student T distribution, the history of the name is that it was published by statistics in some journal, but it was published under an anonymous name. There are various ideas like why it was so, but generally what's known is that the company for which this guy worked didn't allow him to publish under his full name, either because they want to hold the results or because they didn't want to let the competition know that they are actually using this technique in some of their work. I don't know, and I'm not sure about it, but what I'm sure about is that this guy whose name is known used the pseudonym student, and so it's called the student T distribution since then. There are also other tests. So there is also the chi-squared test. In chi-squared test, we used a test statistics, which is the statistics of some, let's say, V squared, where the V comes from a normal distribution. So like a second power of a normally distributed variable that also comes up in many test statistics. And the most or very known chi-squared test is the chi-squared test of a good fit of a data and some given categorical distribution, right? So if you consider this fair or unfair six-sided die, then if you want to compute the probability that the outcome is some given the validity of the null hypothesis, then the distribution of the p-values has this chi-squared distribution. So we then talk about the chi-squared test. There are some more complex tests. There are also some non-parametric tests, which I'm not really listing here. But I also included the F-test, which can be used, which is used in ANOVA testing, which allows you to consider not just two distributions, but even more. So if you have got some larger number of models and you would say, oh, okay, one of them is actually larger or better than all of the others, then the p-values are distributed under this weird F test distribution, and the corresponding test is called ANOVA. So there are really many others, but the good thing is that we actually don't care about them because they all have such requirements which we cannot really fulfill in our situation. So we will deal with the distribution of the p-values in some different way. But before we get to it, the very important thing which I need discussing is this multiple comparisons problem. The multiple comparisons problem arises if we consider many hypotheses, many tests using the same observed data. That doesn't seem bad at the first sight, but let's see. This is very nicely explained by the XKCD comics. So I have taken the liberty of copy and pasting the comics into the slides. So let's say that you have some hypothesis which tells that the jelly beans cause acne. Okay, so we have a hypothesis. So let's try proving that it holds. Well, we cannot really prove that it holds, but what we can do is we can try rejecting the opposite. We can try rejecting the null hypothesis. So let's formulate the null hypothesis, which says that jelly beans does not cause acne. Do an experiment, which means we will find some number of people. We will feed a lot of jelly beans into them, and then they will report their skin state. And then we will compute the p-value, like how likely it is that the resulting problems are given the null hypothesis, which says that these consumption of jelly beans has no influence on your skin. So let's say that the result is that we cannot actually reject the null hypothesis, which means that the p-value is larger than the required statistical required significance level, in this case 5%. Okay, so then that's done. However, consider that we have a theory that only some specific color of the jelly beans is doing it. So maybe there is some specific colorant or flavor in one of these which is causing the skin problems, right? So, okay, let's do some more experiments. So let's try different colors. So let's try 10 different colors. And for all these colors, well, there is no statistically significant result. And let's try another 10 colors. And here there is this interesting situation that for the green color, we have found the statistically significant result. So the p-value for this experiment with the green jelly beans was actually less than the significance level. Which means it gives us the chance to reject the null hypothesis, which means some eager news media might report that the green jelly beans actually are actually linked to some skin problems with 95% confidence, right? It's just 5% chance of the type 1 error. But the problem is that it's actually not really true, right? This type 1 error was limited only in the individual trial, but we are performing 20 trials. Each has the probability of 5%, which is 1 over 20, of falsely producing the statistically significant result. So the expectation of the number of false result is one, right? So this one result is just like the coincidence, or very maybe very much a coincidence of repeating large number of experiments and controlling the error rate of the individual experiments instead of the error rate of the overall experiments of the overall experiment. And this kind of issue is very linked to the situation where you perform some number of tests and you don't report the ones which didn't cause or didn't find the statistically significant results. So if you don't say that you also tried 20 other colors, then it's fine, but you should actually do it. For example, if you have a medicine and you want to prove that it works with some p-value of 5%, then you can just perform 20 experiments by 20 different companies. And one of them will probably be positive, actually. So it will say that it will allow you to reject the null hypothesis that this medicine have no influence on your condition. And then if you do not publish the other ones and just publish the one where the statistically significant result was found, then, well, you have cheated very successfully. Yep. So what I try to say is that Just that some experiment was statistically significant doesn't really mean that it actually allows you to reject the null hypothesis. Like if you don't fulfill the conditions or like cheat by performing a lot of the experiments you didn't tell anybody about, then the result might be just a pure coincidence and nothing more. When we talk about repeated experiments, then what you can also do if you want to impress people, you can say, okay, I have found this very interesting correlation between these two hugely different qualities, and one is the number of people who were killed by venomous spiders, that's the black one, and the number of letters in the spelling bee competition, right? In the US, they have these spelling competitions where the people spell words like small children, and the one which can do the best is the winner. So you can measure the number of letters which were there in the finals, for example, and you can see that these quantities correlate quite a lot. So we could compute the correlation coefficient and perform some test, and it would say us that this is actually like this allows us to reject the null hypothesis that these two quantities are uncorrelated. And if you like consider very large number of these various qualities, various metrics, then it's likely that you will find a pair which will seem to be correlated, but it's just a pure coincidence of actually considering so many pairs of different quantities. And this is not just the question of the media doing things incorrectly. This is really a question of doing quality research. Just for fun, there is a nice paper from 2009, I think, which came out in the Journal of Serendipitous and Unexpected Results, which performs an fMRI on a salmon fish. So the fMRI that's a functional magnetic resonance imaging. That's a way how you can it's a simplification, but the simplification is that you can measure brain activity, and you can measure the brain activity like anywhere in the brain. Right, so the fMRI gives you the measurement that for like each voxel, and by voxel I mean a 3D pixel, so for each small cube in your brain, you get the reading whether the brain is active in that area or not. This is really oversimplification, but enough for our case. What the authors do, the authors consider the following experiment. So let's take one major Atlantic salmon and let it participate in the study. The salmon at 18 inches, it weighed 3.8 pounds. And the interesting part is that it was not alive at the time of the scanning. It was actually frozen already, and then it was just put into the fMRI. Now, it's not known whether it was a male or female, but given the fact that this was actually dead, it was not thought to be an important consideration. Now, what the study looked like, the salmon was shown some number of photographs, and in these photographs there were people in the situations in which either they felt socially inclusive or socially exclusive. And the salmon, that one, was asked to determine which emotions are the people actually displaying. The experiment was fairly standard one, so there were some number of photos, four of them in a row. For each photo, the salmon should try to like decide in his head, in their head, whether it's like a social exclusive or social exclusive situation, which was followed by some resting period. So this is like a fairly standard run. And then the processing was the like normal one. So what are the results? So we have chosen the P level of 0.1%, and we want to, like, we, what is the goal is to find the correlation between the brain activity and the emotions in the images. So if there is some part of your brain which is active exactly when you are shown, I don't know, the socially included people, and not the other ones, then you say, okay, so maybe this part of brain is actually used to recognize this emotion, right? So what we want to find not just one voxel, that's really a small part, but we want to find three neighboring voxels for which this will be the case. And so what the results are, voila. Actually, there were two parts of this dead salmon's brain which showed activity which correlated with the like presented images. So this is obviously like just a funny paper to bring up an important warning that even in the like best available journals, which perform like the top-notch medical research, there are really a lot of methodological problems, and the problem in this case is exactly the multiple comparisons problem. The thing is, there are a lot of voxels in the image. Usually there are large tens of thousands of voxels. And what you do, well, for each voxel, independently, you measure the correlation between the activity and the presented stimuli. So we do a lot of tests, right? And even if we need at least three neighboring voxels of them to be positive, it still will happen by chance, very easily, that the outcome will deemed to be statistically significant, as it happened with the participant, which probably had very little to no activity in their brain. There are some discussion. There is a discussion here about like why the results are noisy, what actually is being picked up by the fMRI machine, and so on and so on. But the main point is that the lot of studies, or quite a lot of studies in very like high profile medical journals, actually don't perform this correction to this multiple comparisons problem. They went through three journals and find out that like approximately only 2/3 of these like highest quality papers available that year did this kind of correction. So 1/3 of the results was like random. And these were like the highest quality journals, right? So in some poster session at some conference, only 1/5 of the participants actually used this correction, which is extremely low. With the corrections included, of course, the results are much more likely and say that with a p-value of, I don't know, 25% or something like which with much higher value, yeah, it was true even for very large very large p-value, that the there is no activity in the brain, which is something what you would expect. Something which people sometimes don't talk about as much as it would be required. There are many ways how you can improve the situation, so I will just show you one way how the situation can be improved. And the one of the simplest way to fix or to improve or to account for these multiple experiments is not to limit the individual error rate or the error rate of the individual experiments, but instead to limit the error rate of the whole, they say, family. So it means of the all number of performed experiments, right? So well, what we can decide, we can define the family-wise error rate is the probability of this type one error happening, but not in one of the experiments, but in any of the experiments, right? So we have got the probability of the union of the facts that one of these results will show this type one error. And in order to limit this error rate overall, the m number of experiments, what we can do is we can actually change the statistical or significance level to the required value divided by the number of experiments, right? It's like a natural thing. And given that the probability of the union is bounded by the sum of probabilities, right, then we can easily show that if we decrease the significance levels of the individual experiments in this way, then the probability of the type one error happening during the course of all the experiments is limited by m. It is actually like, this is not the best or the strongest or the most powerful method. There are some other ones, but this is like outside the scope of the lecture. I just want to bring up the fact that these things are actually happening. So this was like a generic introduction, and now let's get to to our situation. Unfortunately, the slides on this part are not yet finished much. There will be just some illustrations later, so I will write it down now, but I will edit to the slides when I can. So in the model comparison, we have some data set. So we have some trained data, but we won't think about it much. Instead, we will be interested in some test data. So let's say that we have got test data, XITI, and we have some models. So let's say that we have models A and B, and they give us some predictions. So we get the predictions AI and BI. Now, when we take the prediction and the test data, we can use some metric and compute the performance of one of the model on the test set. That can be an accuracy or F1 score or something. Like, the important thing is that this metric is evaluated on the whole test set, right? Not on one element of the test set, but on the whole collection of it. Specifically, the F1 score really computes the number of the true positives and false negatives and false positives, and then compute the final F1 score. So we cannot really say, like, we can say that one example is correct or not, but the overall metric depends on the whole test set. Now, there are several source of variance in the model training and evaluation. One is the randomness during training. During training, we either initialize the weights randomly, or we use some random permutation to go through the data, and so on and so on. So there is some randomness which causes the model with the same training data and the same hyperparameters to behave differently. So this is something which we will not talk anymore. I just mentioned it now, but the only way, or as far as I know, how to measure this effect is to actually train multiple times and write with different seats, and then like looking at the distribution of various results. So then you can, if you like repeat the training for 10 times with 10 different random seeds, you can say that the results are, I don't know, like some performance plus minus some standard deviation. So you can at least measure the standard deviation of the model using the same training, testing data and hyperparameters. So that's the results. So this is something which is true, but it's not what we are interested in now. What we are interested in now is the fact that the test set is just a sample from the data generating distribution. So if you use the models, they will have different test set results. They will have different test examples, and the models might behave differently, right? It may have happened to be the case that in the there are, I don't know, some larger number of threes, or the threes are some specific of kind of threes in the handwriting in digit recognition, and one of the models just works better on these, but it will not work better when it will be presented by the data from the from other humans or other samples. And this is the variance which we want somehow to somehow to limit. When you consider some model A, then if you consider various trains, various possible test sets, then what you could do is you could compute the distribution of results for a different test set. So let's say that this is the metric, right? And this is the probability. So let's say that we have got this like a histogram, this probability distribution, which tells us what the performance of a model is given a randomly chosen test set. So what we observe from this distribution is just one value, right? This value, that's the one test set which we actually use, and we are seeing some performance of the model. So this is an unbiased sample of the mean of this model performance, but it's just one sample. So there is some variance, some variability, some error. And what we are interested in knowing, if we have these two models, whether it is the case that the model A is on average better than the model B or not, right? So whether it looks like this or whether it looks like this. And but we only see one sample from the model A, one sample from the model B, and that's it. So what we will do, let's say that the performance of the model A was better than the performance of the model B. So what we will want to like prove or put forward, the alternate hypothesis, is that the model A is better than the model B. So in order to put this to a test, we formulate a null hypothesis, which is the negation. So it says model B is actually better than model A. And our p-value is the probability of observing a difference between the results, right? When we have models, then we will be discussing the paired test, right? Because we have the same test sets which we use for the model A and for the model B, right? So in the end, we will consider like the difference of performances on the test set, and we will want to show that the mean of the differences and A minus B is like larger than zero, and the alternate hypothesis, the null hypothesis will be that this mean is less or equal to zero. Okay, but the question is where to get these distributions, where to find out how the model will behave on different test sets. The problem is that we don't have the data, right? We don't have the supervision for the test sets, and we would like to somehow find out what the distribution is. And what we will do is we will again turn to the bootstrap resampling. So assume that we have got this one test set with this XITI data. And then we have the model A with predictions AI. And what we will do is we will construct a lot of different test sets. By sampling with repeats. So we will construct test sets of the size as the original test set. But it will be with repetition, right? So if we assume that the original data were sampled independently from the data generating distribution, which is our assumption from the beginning of the course, then this resample also can be considered to be a sample from the original data generating distribution. So this resample will play the role of a randomly chosen test set. Right. So what we can do is we can construct a large number, very large number of test sets, and then we can evaluate our model, right? We have sampled the whole test set, we can compute the metric on the test set. And what gives this? This gives us a lot of outcomes for a lot of test sets. And then we can use these results just as the empirical distribution, right? So what we will get, we will be some like histogram like this, which we can consider to be the distribution of the model performance given randomly sampled test set. So that's a good thing. This resampling works because even if we compute the metric on the whole test set, the test set is composed of individual examples. That's generally might not be the case for all the situations in statistical testing, but in machine learning it is usually the case. So we can use this fact and use this bootstrap resampling to get like a cheap number or have a cheap way of creating a lot of different test sets. From that we can construct both the distribution of performances or for the model for different test sets and also the distribution of differences of the performances. So to show you the results, consider the model for the Isn't It Ironic competition, which will utilize the three invert character n-grams. That's the red one, right? What we do is we show the distribution with 50 bins and 500 sampled test sets. So what we get is this red distribution, and the mean of that is 63.5. The standard deviation is something like 2. And then we can consider another model that will be the green one, which will be the correct 4 grams, and that's the green distribution. So when you look at it, then first thing you notice that it doesn't seem that nice, like it's not a nicely looking distribution, and that's caused just by the fact that we have a lot of bins and too little samples. It seems that 500 tested is a lot, but we don't run the model on the tested anymore. We, during the resampling, we also include the prediction of the model. So it's just the question of computing the metric on the result. So we can do more of them. So if we have still 50 bins, but 5,000 resamples, then even the empirical distribution gets better. So we can see that now it really looks quite nice. And now we would like to conclude whether the performance of these models is statistically significantly different or not? Well, when you look at just these two distributions, then it doesn't seem too likely, right? If you like consider this threshold, then there are a lot of test sets for which the red distribution performs better, while there are a lot of test sets for this green model, the model B, does worse. But the problem here is that they are different test sets, right? So some of the test sets are naturally like difficult, and they are difficult for both of these models. So if we consider like a difficult test set for the model A and a simple test set for the model A, it should have been B, then, well, we will see this difference. But if we use the pair test, if we really consider the results on the same test set, so if we like compute the difference of this, but for the paired elements, then the results are much more optimistic. So that's what we can see here on this side. So this is the distribution of the performance differences for a lot of test sets. There are a lot of quantiles drawn here, which are the p-values, right? So our hypothesis, null hypothesis, is that the difference is less or equal to zero, right? Because that's the null hypothesis which we want to reject. The probability of that happening is the probability of all these examples on the left. And that's exactly 0.5%. So got a bit stuck. So the probability of really seeing the outcome that B is better than A is limited to 0.05 if we assume that the model B is actually better than model A. So the mean of the model A is worse than the model B, which is exactly the threshold which we want to test. So we can say that with the P of 0.5%, the result is statistically significant. If we can, of course, make the significance level smaller. So we can see that if we want to just a percent, then these p-values are more to the right. So the test would be statistically significant even for the larger p-values, and this 0.5% exactly, just by pure coincidence, exactly the limit where it would break. So if we wanted the results with 0.1% significance level, then the result would not be statistically significant. We could not refuse or reject the null hypothesis. Now, if we instead consider the model with 4 and 5 CREMs, then they still differ by a whole percent, or 0.8% of score, F1 score. But you can see that now the distribution of the results for various test sets is much closer, and even the differences are much closer to zero. So in order to provide statistically significant results, the statistical significance level would need to be set to 14.7%, which is like really extremely low or large, depending how you look at it. So we would not be able to reject the hypothesis. So even if, like, when you look at the results, it seems that the green model is like better than the red one, right? Then there is some high probability, 14.7 probability, that you actually observed, like, that you used the test set which was used in the Recodex is exactly such that they behave like the other way on it. So what you do is you get this p-value right out of the test, so you know that what is the chance that the such a bad test set was chosen that the models have a different ordering on it than the one which you assume. So this is how we actually use this test. So when you have some competition, then usually if you have like competitors which are close to each other, you don't just say that like any number is better than the other. Instead, you like compute this p-value of the probability of rejecting, or which will be required for to reject the null hypothesis, to see whether the results are actually statistically significant or not. So then in the end, if you have got some number of participants, then what you do is you like draw lines in situation where this model and this model are statistically significantly different, and don't draw lines if they are not. And sometimes you even say that all these like are first models and all these are the seconds and all these are the third ones, right? Because you want to include the fact that like the specific sample of the test set might have influenced the ordering of the models. And the good thing with this bootstrap test is that it has like very little or quite little requirements, definitely compared to requiring the metrics to be normally distributed and something like that. We will have a simple assignment which will require you to like get these histograms and distributions from the data, so you'll be able to play with it a bit so that you like, can get your hand on it a bit, and not just look at the images but actually be able to compute them. So you can stay tuned. There will also be another assignment on the Wednesday's practicals, which will be the fit of the Gaussian mixture. Like we talked about this clustering using the Gaussian mixtures on the lecture just before the holiday, but I didn't want to add the assignment before Christmas, so we'll do it this Wednesday. So there will be still two new small assignments on the practicals, and that will give us the assignments for at least 120 non-competition points. So it's already a minute past the end, so thank you very much for your attention. The chocolates and the exams and the assignments will be detailed on the Wednesday's practicals. So I'm looking forward to meeting you there, either in person or on the recording. Enjoy the rest of the day. It's probably not possible theoretically to go outside, but still I think going outside for a walk is a good thing, not to sit home all the time. So enjoy a walk if you are going. And thank you very much for your attention. If you have some questions, I'm here and you can ask, but if not, then see you. Bye. Bye-bye.